Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:05 p.m. on April 6, 2012. Yeah. Present, we have Representative Keller, Representative Grunberg, Representative Holmes, Representative Chair Gatto is excused, and myself, Representative Steve Thompson. First things first, housekeeping. Please, in fact, I got to do the same. Please turn off your cell phones. Just turning them to vibrate for some reason in this room still interferes with the recording equipment. Housekeeping's out of the way. And Representative Lynn has joined us also. We have one new bill plus one previously heard this in this order, House Bill 269, Common Interest Communities, and then we have House Bill 367, Senate Companion Bill, SB 151, Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder as Mitigator. Our first bill of today will be House Bill 269, Common Interest Communities, an act relating to the amendment to a declaration that creates a common interest community. And here to continue the presentation of this bill is James Waldo, staff to Representative Holmes. There is a House Judiciary CS. Can I have a motion to adopt the draft CS 27LS1125/M for discussion purposes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
And I will object for discussion.
Okay, Mr. Waldo. Please put your name on the record and describe the change in the draft judiciary CS for House Bill 269.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Lindsey Holmes. The only real change made in the M version is found on the second page of the bill. From lines 7 through 12 in the original bill, there was a paragraph F, which dealt with limitations that a condo association could put on the uses within units. At the last hearing, Representative Keller had some discomfort with that section. After going back and looking at it, we found that the best way to deal with that issue was just to remove the section entirely, which has been done in the M version. So you'll see in the M version that the old F section is gone. The old G section is now the new F section, and the bill has been pared down to what I would say is the most important and specific concern of the folks who brought this bill to our attention.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Waldo. Are there any further questions for Mr. Waldo or the supporter or the sponsor?
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Keller.
I should say thank you.
You're welcome.
Public comment was closed last Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll remove my objection.
Objections removed. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, we will be addressing the CS for House Bill 269. Are there any further questions for the sponsor? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Can I have a motion to move House Bill 269, version M?
Mr. Chair, I'd move CS for House Bill 269, 1125M, with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations. Thank you.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, we've moved CS for HB 269 from the Judiciary Committee, and we'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork.
Thank you.
We're back on the record. Next up, we will hear the Senate Companion Bill to House Bill 367, which is Senate Bill 151 in place of the previously scheduled House Bill. This is an act relating to mitigation at sentencing in a criminal case for a defendant found by the court to have been affected by a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Here to present the bill is Senator Kevin Meyer and his aide, Christine Marigason. Excuse me, Christine. Staff to Senator Meyer. Senator Meyer, please place yourself on the record and provide us with an overview of Senate Bill 151.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it's taken me 2 years to get her last name correct. So.
Thank you.
Yes. Good afternoon, and Mr. Chairman and members of the House Committee, House Judiciary Committee. It's good to be back here. I served on this committee some time ago. For the record, my name is Kevin Meyer. Senator Kevin Meyer represents Southeast Anchorage. And I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 151, which could include fetal alcohol spectrum as a mitigating factor for sentencing. And I want to, at this time, also thank Representative Keller for carrying the House companion on this on the same bill. Both bills are identical. And most of you who know me might think the Senate must have got to me, because normally I am a proponent of aggravators, not mitigators. So I want to caution that this bill is by no means a get-out-of-jail-free bill by any means. If the defendant is involved in a violent crime, then the mitigating factors cannot be used. The intent of this legislation is to have more appropriate sentencing for folks who suffer from this permanent disability that is very unfortunate. It's a disability that the a person is born with. They didn't ask for it. Unfortunately, their mother was drinking while she was carrying them, and they suffer the consequences for the rest of their life. But I think, and by the way, I want to thank you for passing, I don't know if this is appropriate, but passing the bill today, making FASD Awareness Day. When Chief Justice Carpinetti spoke to us as a joint committee, House and Senate, he spoke about smart justice and giving the judges some flexibility in sentencing. Senate Bill 151 would do that. It would give the judges a little bit of flexibility. Using this mitigating factor is not mandatory. It's strictly an option. It's a tool that the judge can use when dealing with someone with FASD. And FASD is kind of an umbrella term, but it's actually a spectrum, fetal alcohol spectrum. And people are all over in this spectrum. Some will have the physical symptoms. Some don't have the physical symptoms, but they all have one thing in common. That's they have brain damage. The brain damage occurred, again, from the alcohol that the mother was drinking while carrying them. So since it is a spectrum, it seemed appropriate that the judge be allowed a flexibility in sentencing for these folks. And as you know, Alaska has the highest grade of FASD in the United States. And what people have told me is that our prisons, our correction systems here in Alaska are disproportionately represented by folks who have the FASD. As I mentioned, it is a permanent disability, and we need to find ways to help people who have this permanent disability. And I personally don't believe longer prison terms is the help. Instead, longer probationary periods, parole, intensive case management, assisted living, managed care, or there's a host of other mental health programs. And I believe you actually have Judge Jeffries online who will describe some of the programs that are available to the judges. And they're much less expensive than actually putting somebody in jail. My office has been working with the FASD Partnership, the Department of Law, the courts, numerous FASD advocates on this bill. This bill has been through three committees on the House side. Three committees, if we're successful here, we'll, on the Senate side. Or excuse me, I'm backwards. The bill has been through three committees on the Senate side, and it's also been three committees on the House side. There's plenty of experts online and here, so if you do have questions, I'll try to answer them the best I can. But we feel that this bill is a small way to help those who suffer from a disability by, again, allowing the judges to have the flexibility to apply more appropriate sentencing for folks that have this disability. With that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your time and your consideration. I know you're all very busy right now, and I just am very grateful that you're hearing this bill.
Senator Meyer, thank you very much. Does the committee have any questions for Senator Meyer? Seeing none, this time we'll... Representative Grunberg.
Page 3...
Darn near got through it.
Page 3, line 26. As Christina and Terry Tibbett and others will remember when we chatted in my office, I was concerned that the main focus would be the defendant's conduct in the case at bar, not their conduct just generally, whether FASD affected them in things unrelated to the particular crime that they were convicted of. and the use of the term conduct on page 3, line 26, I interpret to mean mainly the conduct in the crime that's alleged or it would have been convicted of, because this is in a sentencing. And so we're not using this. In other words, if you have FASD and you don't do well in school, that's not going to necessarily be something the judge would consider. But if it would have potentially affected their conduct here, that is something that the judge should properly be able to consider as a mitigator. And is it the sponsor's intent that the focus would be on the defendant's conduct in the crime for which they've been convicted?
Christine, place yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Christine Maris-Egan. I'm staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you bring up an important point, and as I recall from our discussion, we did have the intent of it applying to the conduct for the particular incident in which this would be applied. And I think that because since we have, I believe, Judge Michael Jeffrey online, he can also address that concern. But yes, we would agree with you in that, in your statement.
Mr. Chair, the reason I'm saying that is because courts don't necessarily, if they look at legislative intent as an issue in a case, look at what some stray legislator might say in the heat of the moment, but they do pay attention to what the sponsor of a bill says that his or her intent is. And you're speaking for the sponsor who's sitting next to you, and I want the record very clear that the emphasis in this issue is on the conduct involving the crime that they're being, they've been convicted on. As I understand that, Senator, that is your specific intent.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, yes, that is my intent.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. I'm still trying to wrap my head around if it's not used as a mitigator in some crimes, as proposed by the bill, why is it not a mitigator for the more serious crime? Either you have it or you don't have fetal alcohol syndrome. I just don't understand. It's the same person. He could commit one crime one day and have the mitigator, another crime the next day, and not have the mitigator. Same person. I'm just trying to wrap my head around that.
This bill has gone through several hearings, and of course, as you go through the process, it's been amended. Some people just felt like, you know, that if they commit a violent crime, if you're the victim, you don't care that that person has FASD or if the person's perfectly normal. You want adequate sentencing. So that's why we made the amendment. To just be the nonviolent crimes, which, again, kind of being new to this whole area, that tends to capture most of the FASD folks. Certainly, they do commit violent crimes as well at times. But I'll ask my Ms. Maris-Egan to shed some light on that, because I think we started out including felonies as your violent crimes, as you're suggesting.
If before she answers, you know.
Oh, go ahead.
Frankly, somebody burglarizes my house or pickpockets me or whatever, I also don't care if they have FASD. They still did the act. Thank you.
Representative Lynn, through the chair, you bring up some very, very good concerns and ones that have been rehashed over and over between all of the different parties involved in crafting the bill that is before you. I would like to point out that, as Senator Meyer said, the intent of the bill was to go after nonviolent offenders, so people who have brain damage, a serious brain dysfunction due to this condition, that are not that may have impulsive behavior, that are very easily influenced by their peers, people that have a really hard time with decision making, that maybe would become a felon simply because they either stole $500 worth of material or because of some sort of property damage or because of drug possession. Those are the people that we were really targeting the legislation for because longer periods of incarceration doesn't help them. It makes them worse. Whereas if they were in a managed care, something with assisted living where you have somebody keeping them on a schedule, they do better, and they don't tend to reoffend. And so the intent was to stop the sort of recidivism that happens with those folks. And as Senator Meyer pointed out, in the case of arson and crimes against a person, we exempted those. And so if you look at your bill on page 3, lines 20 and 21, we specifically exempted, it's AS 1141 and AS 1146-400, which would include arson and crimes against a person. So assault, basically. And that's what the bill basically tries to do.
Thank you.
Question.
I still don't get it, but that's okay.
Mr. Chairman, we just felt like the mitigating factors fits better with the nonviolent crimes, that there is more hope for rehabilitation, and we can do those folks more good by not going to jail for long periods of time than maybe so with the more violent crimes.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, we'll open this up to public testimony. We have a lot of people online and in the room, some of them just for here to answer questions. David Florent from the Disability Law Center of Alaska is here to answer questions. Carmen Gutierrez, Department of Corrections, to answer questions. And Nancy Mead, the Alaska Court System, for questions. Rick Savovatny, Department of Law, for questions. Diane Castro, Department of Health and Social Services, to answer questions. But here to testify on the off-net is Judge Michael Jeffrey. Your Honor, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Thompson. This is Michael Jeffrey, and I'm testifying from Beryl. I've been a resident of Beryl for 35 years and the Superior Court judge here on the North Slope for 29 years. I was on the statewide FAS steering committee with Representative Jewell and Senator Dyson, and also I'm a member of the Alaska Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. I have to say today I'm testifying as an individual Superior Court judge. I'm not testifying on behalf of the Alaska court system. And I am so thankful that the House Judiciary Committee and previously the House Hess Committee has made time in these extremely busy final days of the session to consider HB 367, you know, as a companion bill, SB 151. Concerning adding felical spectrum disorder as a potential mitigating factor in felony sentencing decisions. Just based on, you know, what we've heard so far this afternoon, I just want to give here's an example of a property crime. I had a case where a gentleman on probation was out in the village, and when his probation officer had told, and he was diagnosed, with one of the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder conditions. Probation officer, you know, one of the conditions is you're supposed to try to get employment. So he approached the local construction company that was working and wanted to see about getting a job, and they told him he had to do it online to apply, and he said, I don't have a computer. So they said, come over to our office at the hotel and apply on our laptop. So he did. And, of course, he typed in all his identification information, his contact information, and completed the application, and then walked out the door wearing this pair of Carhartts that he figured would fit him. And the Carhartts had an iPod, I should say, in the pocket. And so he's looking at a burglary charge, a theft charge, and so on. And obviously, this is the kind of person who's slamming them in jail for a lengthy period is not very helpful to the defendant and also the community. I mean, I guess the idea, you know, just briefly, the way this works, and I agree with Representative Grunberg's concern. I can only say that I I personally have always interpreted the language in there that there are two jobs that a defendant has to do. They have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they have the condition, not just suspected, but they actually have it. And the second is that they have to prove that the way that they have it, and there's this big spectrum, and we've talked, you've heard about that, there's this big spectrum that the way it affects them actually did affect their conduct in the incident. And if they can make both of those showings, then the door opens to this mitigating factor being considered in the sentence. Now, what I would say is that the defendant is going to, if they are going to successfully argue that, you know, it should be applied to their particular case, they're going to have to be able to present in their particular case what the particular plan is for them outside of the jail correction system. And, of course, one of those certainly is caring, knowledgeable probation officers and parole officers. But there are programs, you know, again, assisted living programs. The whole point is providing structure. And it can be done in various ways, and they're more available in the cities, less available in the rural areas. But, you know, that's the defendant's job. It's going to have to show, you know, well, what is the plan here? How am I going to be staying out of trouble? And so I very much support this bill. Again, we're back to the smart justice idea of just, you know, huge sentences on nonviolent offenses. Really, you know, for these people, could be mitigated and done in a way that's far less costly to the taxpayers and far more effective with that person and the community. Again, I strongly support the bill, and I appreciate your time so much in having this hearing, and I'm certainly available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Judge. Any questions for Judge Jeffrey from the committee? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your Honor, I don't know if I should ask you this, if it's proper to ask you this, or I should ask one of the other lawyers who's here in the audience, Mr. Slobodny or somebody else. You said that the way this works procedurally, if there's a mitigator, the twin burdens of going forward and proving the mitigator rest upon the defendant, and the defendant must prove the mitigator by clear and convincing evidence, and then also must demonstrate to the satisfaction of the court that they have a way, if they are allowed to prove the mitigator, that the mitigator will be dealt with, in this case, dealt with under their proposed sentence, or the sentence would that the mitigator would be applied to yield. Am I interpreting what you said correctly? First of all, do you feel that you can answer questions on this subject, or should I defer to somebody else?
Okay, Representative Grunberg, and through the chair, yes, I feel I can answer that as best I can. And your summary of the way that these presumptive sentencing law works is accurate as far as I'm concerned. I mean, basically, someone has to prove the mitigating factor to exist by clear and convincing evidence. And then, if it's proven to exist, then it's simply on the table for discussion. And but it's still then for the judge to decide in the end, after argument, hearing argument from both the state and the defense, that it makes sense to actually change the presumptive term. So that's, I think you've accurately stated the way it works.
Follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume that that's the way it works with other mitigators as well?
Yes, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, yes, it does.
And this is because I'm not so familiar with the procedure here, and I know members of the committee are not either. So it's helpful, since once in a while we get a case involving either aggravators or mitigators, it's important, I think, for members of this committee to understand how this thing works. As I understand, under the Blakely decision, the U.S. Supreme Court case, if there's an aggravator, then the defendant or the state has a right to request that the aggravator be tried to a jury. But for a mitigator, there is no similar right to a jury trial on that issue. Am I correct on that, sir?
Yes, Representative Grunberg, through the chair. The only slight change I'd make in what you just said is that the higher courts have held that there are some aggravating factors where there would not need to be a jury trial. For example, some of the aggravating factors are based strictly on someone's, like, criminal record. Well, you don't have to have a jury trial about whether someone has so many convictions or certain kinds of convictions. But the aggravating factors about, well, gee, is this most serious conduct or was there deliberate cruelty or things like that, would have to be going to a jury unless the defendant agreed that they apply, which does happen sometimes. But one thing that factors in here is that the legislature some years ago, made the decision to depart from the previous practice, which is having a set year of jail time for certain presumptive sentences. And instead, the legislature decided to have presumptive ranges. And when we're working within the presumptive range, we don't have to prove a mitigating factor or, for that matter, an aggravating factor. And you can just go on the arguments during the hearing and so on. Where the mitigating factor comes up is if you want to reduce the jail time, active jail time, below the minimum of the range of presumptive sentences. And then that's when that mitigating factor comes up. And the legislature has also said that there are limits to how far down it could be done. And if the presumptive term is like 4 years or more, then it's going to be not less than half of the presumptive term. If it's under 4 years, there's more flexibility. But that's just, again, there's nothing, what I'm talking about, and others certainly might have additional comments, but this is the way the whole aggravating, mitigating factor system works. It's nothing special with this particular one that's being proposed.
May I continue, please?
Follow-up question, Representative Grunberg. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't recall this committee, certainly not this year, the last few years, really laying out how these mitigators work. And I think it's very important that we understand individually and collectively and for the record how this whole thing works. It's kind of an unusual process, as you can see. The clear and convincing evidence, that applies for all mitigators, all the 19 and now 20 mitigators, all must be proven by the defendant by clear and convincing evidence. From what I understand you said, Judge. And I'm wondering if there is, and I do not want to stray into an area that you wouldn't feel comfortable answering or that the canons of ethics would frown on your answering, so please feel free to decline if you wish, and I'll ask one of the other attorneys. Is there any precedent or statute or anything that requires that the defendant bear the burden of going forward and that it be clear and convincing rather than some other standard? And as part of that, I'm going to sort of a compound question, but it gets into the same area. Has the constitutionality of that process been adjudicated in this state by an appellate court or a trial court, to your knowledge, Judge?
Okay, Representative Grunberg, and then through the chair. I think we are getting to the point where it might be better if one of the attorneys in the audience talk, but I did want to mention that, of course, this burden that the defendant has in a mitigating factor by clear and convincing evidence also applies to the state if they want to prove an aggravating factor. They have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. The basic scheme, and by the way, I believe the legislature, when it passed this presumptive ranges, was responding to the Blakely decision that you mentioned earlier, to give more flexibility right from the get-go, and that's drastically reduced the amount of cases that are going like where these mitigating factors need to be applied and so on. But I can say that the basic scheme has been upheld by the higher courts, but getting much beyond that, I defer to others.
Just one final question.
Follow up.
I have a hearing loss. And did you say a higher court has or has not adjudicated the issue?
I have a hearing loss also, so I appreciate the question. Has, it's, they said it's been upheld, basically, would be a better word.
Thank you. Thank you for your allowance.
Joined by Representative Pruitt. Further questions of Judge Jeffrey from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Your Honor.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Also online, we have Trish Smith. Trish, are you there?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do we have anybody from OPA or the Public Defender online?
Not that I am showing here. We have Department of Health, Postal Services, Department of Law, Alaska Court System, Disability Law Center of Alaska, Alaska Department of Corrections.
Okay, I don't know if the disability, what? I may ask some of those questions to the Disability Law Center. I'd be interested in getting any testimony from the defense bar on the kinds of stuff we were talking
about. Christine, would you come back up and place yourself back on the record again?
My name is Christine Marisigan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. Through the chair, Representative Greenberg brings up an interesting point in that he would want to hear from, like, the Public Defender Agency, and they have testified on this bill in previous committee hearings on the other body, and you'll note that they did give the bill a zero fiscal note, and we have been in discussion with them in crafting the bill that is in front of you today.
Question, Representative Greenberg.
Well, no, you please go ahead. I may ask staff if they can get them on the line or something, because my questions don't go so much to the physiological issue here as to the way it works legally.
All right, next we'll go to Trish Smith. Trish, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, place your name and affiliation on the record and we'll hear your testimony.
For the record, my name is Trish Smith. I work for Volunteers of America. I'm the Director of Prevention and Intervention Services. I would just like to say that I support this bill, but I think it is necessary to help some people be successful, and that it's not that they won't continue to go through the system over and over again. For an example, I would like to share one lady that I've worked with as the family advocate in the court system. She came to court one day. She had this nice list of about 9 things on it that she told the judge that she was going to accomplish in the following week. When she returned the next week, she hadn't accomplished anything on the list, and the judge asked her why she hadn't accomplished anything, and she said, well, I went to this office to meet with this person, and she was telling me I needed to write these things on the list, but I didn't know that I was supposed to accomplish them or to be successful by doing everything on that list. So those little things that some of us take for granted that we think are so easy to do, for someone affected by FASD, they just don't make that connection to realize that they need to do that in order to be successful according to the law and what they're involved with. So I really appreciate this openness that you're willing to look at things differently, and I am here to answer any questions that I can if you need to. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Representative Greenberg has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. We've just been dealing with some other legislation that deals with competency to stand trial. You folks on the committee will remember that. And this mitigator may be quite different from the rest of the judicial proceeding, because a person might very well plead nolo contendere or even guilty, and there not be any real question, like the fellow who walked out with the Carhartts and the iPod pad or whatever it was, iPod. But the real question, particularly with such a high burden of proof, that's a very high burden, clear and convincing, and you have somebody who is already developmentally challenged here, may have great difficulty assisting in their own defense to prove this mitigator. And this may be an unusually hard road to hoe for the people who are affected by this. And the members need to know, and that's why I'm asking these questions, because the way it works may be very, very difficult for the particular class of people it's designed to protect. And I'm wondering, Ms. Smith, or even the judge or anybody else, I'd like some focus on the testimony on how these people are going to be able to use this with such a high burden. Ms. Smith, would you, do the chair like to answer that, or do you want to defer to somebody else?
Chair, I think this is Trish Smith. I think somebody else would be better able to answer that than I would.
Okay. Further questions to Ms. Smith? Seeing none, we now have Quinlan Steiner from the Public Defender's Agency online. That would be one that you needed to have a question of. Quinlan, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, place yourself and your name and your affiliation on a record, and we have some questions.
Certainly. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm a public defender for the state of Alaska.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Steiner, for coming on the line. I don't know if you heard my questioning so far of Judge Jeffries and Ms. Smith. I am concerned. I wasn't aware of how the burden of persuasion and the burden of going forward worked with these mitigators. And I don't know if you heard my comments, but we have a class of people here who may be very significantly impaired in their ability to assist in their own defense. And it's one thing if a person is unable to stand trial and they therefore can't be convicted if they can't aid in their own defense. But it's quite another to have somebody who can't prove their defense, and therefore they're stuck without being able to use the mitigator. It'll work in exactly the opposite way. And I'd like to know how this thing works, and if there's a problem, what we should do about it.
Through the chair, I was unfortunately detained, and I didn't hear the prior testimony or your prior questioning. I can describe a bit about how mitigators work, and then maybe that will help and answer your question, or you could answer me, ask me further questions. But generally speaking, with a mitigator, it would be the defense burden to come forward and establish that. And in cases of diagnosis for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, it would be the defense putting forth experts to meet that burden, and that would usually involve a current diagnosis or potentially one that had been previously made by a treatment team that's qualified to do this. And mitigators and aggravators are a high burden, less for the defense because it's not governed by Blakely. The state needs to prove its aggravators beyond a reasonable doubt. But for the defense, it would be, you know, the clear and convincing burden.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah. I think you got the gist of my question. My concern is as a practical matter. Now, I would assume, and there are the two phases. Number one, whether the individual is competent to stand trial, or in the language of a movie that starred Richard Dreyfuss and Barbara Streisand, whether they're nuts. That's the name of the movie, Nuts. Maybe you saw it. It's a great movie. It dealt with exactly this issue. And the question would be, the person, ironically, who might have the best defense or the best chance at proving a mitigator might be the kind of person who was totally incapable of aiding in their own a burden of proof on this. They're so developed, so disabled, that they cannot do anything, and it would be very clearly shown that they would have this mitigator. And I'm wondering, in the real world, Mr. Steiner, how this currently works and how this will work if we keep the current shifting burden of proof and process the way it is without changing it in some way.
You're talking about just going with what's drafted here, the new Section 20, right?
Right, yes, there's been no change to the bill.
Yeah, I mean, if through the chair, if somebody comes in and makes a claim, or it's, the issue is raised about whether or not they're competent to stand trial, that's a fairly high burden to establish, and that's all done pre-trial. And that would really be with respect to whether or not they had the capacity to assist in their defense. The mitigator itself doesn't go towards that issue about capacity to assist in defense. So it would really be governed by the facts of the case and then whether or not you had an expert opinion that could state that the person has this diagnosis and that that contributed in some way to their conduct that's been charged. You'd really have to sort of make a nexus between the two, I think, under this language.
My question, we're honing in on where I wanted to, the chair, where I wanted to go with this, which is, how important is it that the defendant be able to assist in their, I'm going to call this their own defense, it's their own mitigation. How essential is it that they can participate? And what happens if somebody can't? Can you do it without their participation? Are they in a catch-22? I think the members of the committee see where my questioning goes. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Steiner.
Through the chair, I'm not sure. Theoretically, I'm not sure you're in a catch-22. If the court finds that you're able to assist in your defense, then theoretically you should be able to assist in the pleading of this mitigator. Theoretically, you know, if this court arguably made a mistake in the competency finding, that would, you know, potentially have an impact on your ability to establish this mitigator. Although, generally speaking, if somebody is more disabled, less able to function or assist, you're more likely to get this diagnosis, assuming you have the history and the other factors to link whatever disability they have to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and drinking of the mother during pregnancy. Theoretically, I don't think you have a problem, and practically, you probably don't have a problem in that regard.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Grunberg.
Just one example. I look at the last line of the bill, and impaired brain function in the range of permanent brain defects, and now this is the key phrase, caused by maternal consumption of alcohol during pregnancy. Here we have somebody who's an adult, they're at least 18, and it's decades since the mother consumed alcohol, and the question might be, this person may not know who their mother was, they may have been abandoned at birth, and or they may not have any current mental ability to establish anything about the mother. Now, in a village setting or something, there would be other people who would know, presumably. But let me give you an example. I have a son who's adopted. Fortunately, he's very bright, but we adopted him from Thailand. His mother went in under a assumed name to a hospital in Bangkok, Thailand. They can't find her, can't find the father. He was in an orphanage, and he came to us when he was 18 months or a couple months shorter than that. How could he, particularly if he was impaired, establish, except maybe genetically or something, whether this was established caused by maternal consumption of alcohol during pregnancy? How will that work in a complete abandonment, something like with Daniel?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I'm the person to answer that question. I don't know how much that fact is necessary for a diagnosis. I don't know whether or not if you totally exclude any factual history establishing alcohol consumption during pregnancy that you can still do a diagnosis. I'd have to look into that if I understand you correctly. It may be possible to obtain a diagnosis without that historical fact being proffered by somebody.
Maybe,
but I couldn't say for sure.
Mr. Chair, maybe we have somebody else who's either here or online who can fill us in on that.
Yes, we do. And Ms. Mary Gason?
Once again, Christine Mayer Segan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you once again always ask me such insightful questions. With the mitigator factors, I just would like to point out that we also have mental disease or defect as a mitigating factor, and that we really crafted this language that's in the bill before you to kind of follow with the same sort of procedures where that has also been established. However, in your questions about diagnosis, through the chair, I would like to bring out Ms. Castro, who is the expert in this field, and she'll be able to answer your questions regarding diagnosis.
Through the chair. Touché on using the Section 8, I think you were mentioning Section 18, which was my amendment, and I didn't think of any of this stuff when we did that, and this bill raises issues. I don't want to hold up this bill or anything, but this is an area, and I didn't know clear and convincing was the standard until just a few minutes ago. I want to be sure that this is fair.
Could we call up Diane Castro? She's with the Department of Health and Social Services. Yes, put your name and affiliation on the record, and we'll have you answer some of the questions.
Good afternoon. Diane Castro. I'm the Prevention Manager for the Division of Behavioral Health within the Department of Health and Social Services. So, do you want me to just proceed with some comments regarding diagnosis? Part of the work that I do at Department of Health and Social Services is work with the process that we've developed internally for establishing diagnostic services for the state of Alaska. We began this process back in 1998 when we established the Office of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, back when Karen Perdue was commissioner, and I was asked to staff that office. So at that time, we did not have any we had very little diagnostic capacity at that time. We had a few doctors who did provide diagnosis, but the majority of our Alaska citizens had to go to Seattle for diagnosis. So we worked very closely with the University of Washington, who has one of the kind of gold standards of diagnostic process. It's called the 4-digit diagnostic code. We have brought that to Alaska. In 2000, we started the development of diagnostic community-based teams. And the important piece here is that it is a team that is doing a diagnosis. A question that was asked earlier this week in House Hess was related to, can a doctor do a diagnosis? Yes, a medical doctor can do a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome because it is a medical diagnosis. But all they're doing kind of through that diagnosis is looking at the facial dysmorphology, which is a very specific change of facial features that are specifically impacted by alcohol. So that's one way you can know. And they also can do growth deficiencies, which is another part of the overall diagnosis. What the doctor does not do, and which is very important, particularly for this bill, is do the central nervous system diagnosis and looking at the capacity and the damage done to the brain and what the person can and cannot do based on that damage and that disability. So we currently have 8 diagnostic teams around the state. They all use the same diagnostic process. They use a team. It includes a medical doctor, someone who can do psychological testing, a psychologist, psychiatrist, someone who is capable and trained in those skills. We also have either or both, someone who can do speech and language testing and someone who can do motor skills testing, occupational therapist, a physical therapist, someone along that explore that, those challenges. So those are kind of the areas. So with a diagnosis, the 4-digit code looks at 4 things, and one of them is maternal alcohol use. So you have maternal alcohol use, you have the CNS, central nervous system damage, you have growth, and then you have the facial dysmorphology. So in order to get a diagnosis of one of the various prenatal exposure to alcohol diagnoses, FASD is not a diagnosis in and of itself, it's the spectrum, and then there's a number of diagnoses under there. So in order to get that, you have to range and evaluate each of those 4 categories. You can get a diagnosis of FAS without documented maternal drinking, particularly if the facial dysmorphology is there, which is very specifically linked to alcohol exposure. And then through the other kinds of damage, there can be a partial FAS. Sometimes that will be a diagnosis if they don't have full, complete maternal history. But then oftentimes what we have is, I think as you kind of alluded to, someone in the community knows that mom drank. Mom may not say, yes, I drank, but there is some documentation of suspected alcohol exposure. So we can get a diagnosis without maternal documentation. Certainly if we have it, we prefer it. But again, on the diagnosis of the 4-digit, we go then, we range each of those on a scale of 1 to 4. So if you only have a little bit of documentation about maternal drinking, you might only get a 3, or something. You might get a lesser number. So that's pretty much how it works.
May I?
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Very helpful. And I know we can't cure all the world's ills today in this bill. It's one step. It's, as Neil O'Copenin would say, incremental. You're a state agency. I assume your team or a representative of your team would testify at this phase of the trial if the issue were raised?
Through the chair, that certainly could be a possibility. And kind of in addition to that, one of the things that we also ask of each of our teams, because again, we want to have diagnostic consistency from community to community around the mm-hmm. state of Alaska, is that in addition to just giving the diagnosis of your child has static encephalopathy related to prenatal exposure to alcohol, well, mm-hmm. what does that mean? That's kind of okay, so what? So what we also then ask is for an overview and kind of a recap of the challenges that person, where are in from the testing, where are the areas that this person is having difficulty with? Is it with their memory? Is it with their cause and effect? Is it with their ability to control their large and small motor skills? Mm-hmm. So they do an assessment. So that assessment is then the parent and or the child or adult at this point would have a copy of that would give a very specific analysis of the disability and what it is and is not affecting in that individual person. So that would be a very good document to have and to be able to use in the courts.
And if I may.
Go right ahead.
This language in the bill, all this stuff is on page 3, so I'm not going to have the page. Lines 23 and 24. That language is carefully crafted, sounds like to me, to cover all of those things you've just said. And I see Christine nodding. Okay, good. Another question to you and possibly Mr. Steiner and Mr. Slobodny. Since you work for the state, let me back up here. In about what percentage of the cases that will involve this mitigator would you and your team be the expert witness? Would you anticipate as a regular? I'm going to ask a bunch of questions now on how this will work. And maybe we could ask Mr. Slobodny to come up with Ms. Casco, and we also have Mr. Steiner, so we ought to have a panel. And I want to see how this is going to be put together. Could we do that, sir?
Okay. As long as we're not getting too far in the weeds.
Could we have Mr.
Mr. Slobodny, would you come up and join us, please?
You'll see, I'm not going to be in the weeds, but we got to see.
Right.
So there's no conflict of interest. That's where I'm from.
We also have a David Florent from the Disability Law Center of Alaska online.
I want a prosecutor and defense and the folks from the team.
Mr. Slobodny, would you place yourself on the record, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Slobodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the
company. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the panel. I'm going to say the panel. How is this going to work? Will there be a conflict of interest? Because I'm going to call you the team. Will the team be working for the prosecution or the defense, or is it going to be a neutral court-appointed team? And because if it's going to be for one side or the other, then there are going to be two teams involved in this thing here. This is going to be, could be a trial within a trial. This would be very complicated. And I would ask one or all of you, how is this going to work?
This is Diane Castor. How about I start just so we understand how the diagnostic process works, and then the attorneys can deal with the other issues.
I'm interested in whether there's a conflict of interest, and if so, how the court will, like they would appoint you as a neutral court, neutral, or how is this just going to work?
Through the chair. I don't quite know how it will work in the court system, but what I can tell you is how the diagnostic process works. Is that in some of these cases, we've been diagnosing in Alaska now since 2000. So anyone who was diagnosed back in the year 2000 is, and maybe was, 10 years old, is now 22 years old. They would be a perfect person who might be in this situation. Mm-hmm. They will already have a diagnosis, so they won't need to be re-diagnosed.
Okay.
Unless there have been significant changes, which sometimes in any diagnosis you can decompensate and, there can be some changes. But most often, if the person was diagnosed at an age of, 8 to 10 beyond, the diagnosis is going to be a pretty clear diagnosis. If they were diagnosed at the age of 3, you may need to do a new diagnosis to be able to capture some of the central nervous system deficits that may not have been caught at an earlier age. But let's say it's someone who was diagnosed at 10, they are now 22, they should have a diagnosis already. They would have that. We always tell families to make sure you keep this because it will be something you want to keep in your records. And then it would not necessarily be someone having to come and testify about the diagnosis of that person, unless there were then questions related to the diagnosis. Now, if it's an adult that is 22 and has never been diagnosed, but has been diagnosed with multiple other things, which is often the case with this population, they often get multiple diagnoses for the very reason that you brought up, is that oftentimes we don't know their maternal drinking patterns. So they could be in an adoptive situation or in foster care or various things, and we don't have that information. So they've had other diagnoses of ADHD or autism or various, there's a number of diagnoses that have similar behaviors. And so they might not have an FASD diagnosis. Then it would be incumbent upon the family, the person, the individual, the defense, I'm guessing, to go and seek a diagnosis at that time for the purposes of the court. and then who would be an expert? I mean, I would assume the diagnostic team would definitely be an expert witness in this case and could talk about the diagnosis and what it means.
Yeah. Under the rules of court in the cases, if a person's a professional and they possess knowledge which may aid the court in establishing a particular issue, they can be established as certified as an expert in the case. That's well established. That's the standard, and I assume that would be here. I'm going to ask the two attorneys, do you folks, through the chair if I may have a little leeway.
All right, Ed.
Do you folks see this process being something that would be by stipulation, that to be sure that we don't have dueling experts, or is it going to be dueling experts? And I'd ask both attorneys how they see this thing going down.
Mr. Srobotny.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I can't answer that question. It's going to be fact determinative in each case. There's going to be cases that are stipulated to. Probably the majority, but that's just a wild guess on my part. It depends upon whether, you know, what's brought under the syndrome as to this mitigator. So it's going to be fact determinative by each case. I think there's certainly going to be instances where the prosecution is well aware of I was going to use the word legitimate. That's not the clearly established person with this syndrome, and stipulate to the mitigator. There are going to be cases that are going to be litigated.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Steiner.
Mr. Steiner, are you online still?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, so would you like to weigh in with an answer on this also?
Yeah, I think that's essentially correct. A lot of the cases that come up now, there's a pre-existing diagnosis, and the state may just stipulate to it because it's clear and obvious. And then there's questions about whether or not that diagnosis, there's a nexus between the diagnosis and the conduct and the case, and that could potentially be subject to litigation. The diagnosis could be subject to litigation, and then there would be potentially multiple experts testifying. But my guess would also be that the majority of the cases, it's probably already going to be established and not necessarily be the subject of a lot of litigation, but it is a very fact-specific question, especially because of the nexus component. And that may require experts.
Thank you, Mr.
Well.
And I appreciate the witness's indulgence in allowing me to wander a bit, and your indulgence, and I think that we've gotten some important testimony here.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions of the three panelists that we have online? Representative Keller.
Mr. Srobotny, if you would, just you want to give an educated guess, how many cases is this going to affect a year? I know that's an impossible question to answer, but.
Through the chair. When this bill first came forward, I tried to that out and ask professionals in the field, and I got such wild numbers that there's an indeterminate fiscal note for the Department of Law. I mean, we started with one expert saying, depending upon the geographic location, up to 90%. We had other people, I think it was University of Washington, was saying maybe 0.03%. I mean, so, you know, I tried to I can't do a fiscal note for that. I mean, at 0.03%, I could have gone with zero, but I, you know, if it's 90, it's, you know.
Follow up, Representative Keller.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much, and as I anticipated, but maybe for Diane. The other thing, when this came up in the committee that everybody hates, the question was whether or not there are enough services to for the judge to apply to solve the problem. And what occurred to me is no. There's a fuzzy connection between services and a court here, and in a way that's probably I don't want to say a healthy thing, but I think it is actually. There's the FASD partnership, you know, that is there to advocate primarily for the victims. You know, has a broad range of people that are watching and helping. You know, in the situation. So even though there's no direct, clear link between the court and services, this opens up options that I think are there. And so, anyway, I just want to give you a little bit of that from what I my perception of what, at least what I learned in the last hearing. So.
Further questions from the committee, Representative Lynn.
This is probably to you. Is there any? Any consumption whatsoever of a mother during pregnancy, like one drink during 9 months, 2, 5, 10, whatever, does that always result in some degree, maybe a minor degree of FAS? Many of us who are over 50, 60 years old have no idea whether our mothers consume, unless they're a known teetotaler, we have no idea. My mother, I know she drank socially. That was about it. But I have, you know, no idea back in 1932-33 if she had one drink, no drinks, or 100. I have just no idea. Does it always result in FAS to some degree, maybe non-detectable?
Through the chair. That's a very good question.
And could I have it? Yeah, you know.
Well, I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay. I will good, defer. Good. I don't want it on the record. But you see why I'm going with this.
Well, what I can say is, and this is the, I think the challenge of this disability is that there is no known amount of alcohol that causes prenatal exposure to alcohol that causes the damage that we see, because there are so many factors relating to alcohol. Every person metabolizes alcohol differently. I will metabolize it differently than you. You know, we all metabolize it differently. And indeed, the fetuses metabolize alcohol differently. So that there are cases where there are twins, paternal twins, mom drank, one has full-blown FAS, meaning they've got the facial features, the disability. The other one has no facial features. So those two fraternal twins have different, you know, genetic makeup, and they metabolize alcohol differently. Same amount of alcohol in the womb, but it was different. So this is part of the challenge. And because some people metabolize, you know, can drink very little, and there are impacts, and other people can seemingly drink more significant amounts, and you don't see the disability, that's part of the reason we have a spectrum of disability. But what I would say as a preventionist and kind of the stand that we take in our department is, why would you take the chance?
Well, I agree. So,
you know, our belief is no alcohol during pregnancy is the way we are going to end this disability. Because the other good news about this disability is it does not carry on genetically. Someone who has fetal alcohol syndrome and gets pregnant, does not drink alcohol, they will have a baby that is totally free of this disability. It does not carry on. You have to have consumed alcohol during pregnancy to have this disability. So that's the good news. It is preventable at some point in our time if we continue moving forward. The sad news is that there are a lot of people that do have this disability. And kind of I'll extend a little back to the previous question about the numbers is just to give you an idea of how many what our current prevalence rates are saying is that currently our prevalence rates that are done through the Alaska Birth Defects Registry through the Division of Public Health, they are showing that we have about 15 births a year that are FAS and about 155 to 160 births that are prenatally exposed with some level of disability. So that means that every year that, you know, 160 babies are born that have some level of this disability, and it is a lifelong disability. So that accumulates every year, additional people are added to the number of people that have this disability.
That's a very, very good answer. I really appreciate it. I think that clears up a lot of stuff. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Further questions? Seeing none, Ms. Castro, Mr. Slovotny, Mr. Steiner, I thank you very much for your help in answering all of the questions. Is there anybody else online or in the audience that would like to testify on Senate Bill 151? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. We're back to the committee. Discussion by the committee. Further discussion? If not, then could I have a motion to move the bill?
Okay. I move that we report Senate Bill 151, Judiciary Version 24LS 1132 uniform with committee recommendations and the attached fiscal notes from committee.
Is there any objections? Seeing none, we have moved Senate Bill 151 from committee, and it is now 2:16 p.m., and we are adjourned.